Fintan is one of the best-known 19th century Irish art historians. He's a massive influence on the field. His Sources in Irish Art is a standard textbook for all of our students. His most recent book is Ireland Art, Union and Nationhood from 2012 with Ashgate. I suppose Fintan's best known for his work on the relationship between Ireland and Britain, but writes much more broadly in terms of art of the 19th century, British art, Irish art. Oh, and he did an exhibition with Roy Foster, of course, which a lot of people know, Conquering London, England, the Irish in Victorian London, in the National Portrait Gallery in 2005.
So Nicol's painting of a guy arriving, a poor Irish migrant arriving in Liverpool, is in the Scottish National Galleries. And then people like Niamh in the audience have looked at innumerable illustrated London news images of people being evicted, people leaving on boats, etc. So those images of examining themes of art and migration are not hard to find, basically. But in this study and in this little talk I'm going to give today, I want to go beyond what you might call, without being disparaging, the huddled masses. And that in the research that I'm doing, I'm trying to reconfigure art history, as you'll see. I'm also looking at Ireland and imperial culture, people going away for reasons of the empire. People migrating. I'm also interested in objects migrating, as I said, and of the Irish in Britain. And moving away from the kind of, not so much that they were all being caricatured, but the dominance in art historiography is that Irish and Britain are, as Lewis Perry Curtis and others have written, is that Irish people are these simianized creatures in London. And there's more to the story than that. And I just want to do, without disparaging poor old Lewis Curtis or anything, but going beyond that, you know, he wrote his book back in the 80s, so it's time to get a new interest. So my interests are as much about suggesting a change to art history as a discipline, an examination just of migration. So basically, as you'll see, if we ever get to see the images, I'd like to see the discipline adapt or change from a dependence on the old-fashioned notions of national schools to something broader, and one less focused on national boundaries. And I'll explain all that in a while. After decades of visiting museums in the United Kingdom, France, the United States, and elsewhere, and observing painted Irish figures or painted Irish objects in artworks that are celebrated as being British or French or American, it strikes me that an Irish diasporic art history needs to be articulated so as to provide an alternative to the pigeonholing of artists and art solely within a singular national context. Art historians and viewers need to become aware that exile is a feature of art and should be brought into the discussion of a national experience. So over the years, I've been trying to break down, this is in a book I did way back in the 90s, to break down national boundaries in art history. And in the past, I looked at a painting like this by a French realist painter, Gustave Courbet. And I also looked at my assistant here, when I put on Fort Maddox Brown. I also looked at a painting by his contemporary in England, a pre-Raphaelite painter called Ford Maddox Brown. And I looked at these two pictures, if Emily can switch back and forth, in terms of how the Irish feature, go back to the Courbet now, in terms of how, this is exhausting, in terms of how the Irish feature in two very well-known paintings by a French and a British artist. In 1854, in Paris, while composing his immense, and you've got to take my word for it, on the original slides, I gave you the centimetres and everything, but it's a huge painting, twice as big as this wall, window here. It's in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. In 1854, while composing this immense painting, which is called The Studio, and here's the artist, The Studio and the Artist, Courbet wrote to his friend Champfleur, who's an art critic and a novelist who also appears in the painting, that he, Courbet, was including in the canvas, and I wrote all about this 20-odd years ago, an Irish woman suckling a child. And he writes, I saw this woman in a London street. Now, this is 1854. I saw this woman in a London street wearing nothing but a black straw hat, a torn green veil, and a ragged black shawl, and carrying naked baby under her arm. Now, I have to say to you, because I'm not talking about the famine as such. I'm not a historian of the famine. I'm not a visual historian of the famine. I'm talking about displacement post-famine. So, you know, you can join the dots as you will. This woman sits on the floor in the center of Courbet's painting next to the artist's easel, exposing what the art historian Linda Nochlin has referred to as her bare, flabby, pale, unhealthy legs, and as such, she swells to the dimensions of an insurmountable, dark stumbling block on that highway to constructive progress. A decade later, in London, in 1865, in the exhibition that accompanied the display of Work, and that's the name of the painting, Ford Madox Brown described how he was including representations of such famous contemporaries as Thomas Carlyle, the bearded guy here with the hat, as well as the guy beside him, the Christian socialist Frederick Denison Morris, while behind, on a shaded bank, this crowd here, are different characters out of work. Everybody else is working. Haymakers, and again, I've written about all this so you can read it in a book called Visual Politics. On the shaded bank are different characters out of work, haymakers in quest of employment, a stoic from the Emerald Isle with hay stuffed, and he's the guy leaning against the tree, with hay stuffed in his hat to keep the draft out, and I'm quoting from Brown. His need for stoicism just at present being, as he's being short, he's short of baccy, a young shoeless Irishman, see his profile there, and his wife feeding their firstborn with cold pap. So we get a range, and this is back to me now, a range of Irish types, a pathetic immigrant family, a somewhat suspicious-looking idler leaning against a tree, and hard-working navvies and agricultural labourers, and some of the navvies are Irish as well. Just over 10 years ago, I did an exhibition co-curated at the London National Portrait Gallery on the Irish and Victorian London, and my fellow curator and I showed and wrote about a range of images of Irish women in 19th century London who acted as models for British and French artists. One of the most intriguing were photographs of a young Irish migrant woman, Mary Ryan, and she's the woman here, by the photographer Julia Margaret Cameron, produced in the 1860s. Ryan was modelled by Mrs. Cameron in such fictions as this one here, seen from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Some years later, Mary Ryan fell in love with Henry Cotton, who's the man she's embracing in this suit kind of recreation of Romeo and Juliet. He's shown, obviously, in Romeo. And she ended up marrying him, and he then became chief commissioner for Assam in northern India, an elite in chief, and he became leading members of the Anglo-Indian elite. Now, can I have Bingham? In a more recent publication, Ireland on Show, which came out about 4 years ago, I discussed two 19th century American paintings, one by George Caleb Bingham, which you can see here, a frontier artist from the Midwest in the States, entitled Country Election. And did you get the harnet? So I show that, I talked about that Bingham picture, and then I talked about this painting by an Irish-born artist called William Harnett, which is called A Still Life. Yep, that is the right one. A still life, violin and music. Could you go back to the Bingham? Painted in Columbia, this painting by Bingham, in Columbia, Missouri, that is. The Bingham represents a group of Midwesterns participating in the political process with what a contemporary newspaper described as a well-set Irishman. He's the well-set Irishman in the red shirt up there, putting his hand on the Bible before he votes. A well-set Irishman in a red flannel shirt in the centre of the painting, swearing an oath before casting his vote. Harnett again now, please. In the Harnett, a single sheet of music, which you can see behind the violin, acts as a central background to the illusionistic display. This is all a painting, an illusionistic painting, behind the violin. This sheet can be easily read as being a melody by Tom Moore, St. Kevin, or by that lake whose gloomy shore, and take my word for it, you can't read it on this slide, which had appeared in volume 4 of Moore's Melodies, originally published back in 1811. This is now about 1888. More immediately, in the context of later 19th century USA, Harnett's still life was possibly exhibited in Philadelphia, as far as we know. These are just called still life, so it's difficult to know which still life, but we know he exhibited a bunch of still life in Philadelphia in the late 1880s. In most of these works, the artists themselves are contemporaries who viewed the individual paintings shortly after they were created, identified the Irish dimension. If such an Irish aspect was so readily available in French, British, and American-based art production in the years between 1850 and 1880s, we need to acknowledge the visualization of exile in art. Using Ed Said's term, Joe Cleary from this august institution, in the introduction to co-edited book, Cambridge Companion to Modern Irish Culture, Joe Cleary referred to Ireland as an exemplary nursery of exilic consciousness. Given that over the centuries, Ireland attracted migrants into the country, as he claims, as Joe Cleary writes, as colonial settlers, where Ireland was and was not home, who maintained what Cleary calls an outlander mentality, going on to say that a persistent pattern of outward migration can also be observed. For example, the Irish poor compelled to emigrate to Britain or the United States in the post-famine period. The results of this inward and outward migration left a seriously unstable culture, which has led to the need to question the notion of anything resembling a definable Ireland-based Irish art. Can we have the next slide by Yeats? Lovely. Even more years ago, in the catalogue that accompanied an exhibition on John Butler Yeats, he's the father of the poet and all that crowd, held in Albany, upstate New York, I discussed that John Butler Yeats's friendship with the American artist John Sloan, who's shown here in the far left. He's the artist of this painting, which is called Yeats at Petit Pas, which is the name of a hotel in New York where he stayed, or lived actually for about 10 years. I discussed the Irish painter's friendship with the American artist Sloan and the latter's creation, that is Sloan's creation of this painting in 1910, which is now in Washington. The details of this friendship have been fully recorded by the late Bill Murphy in his biography of John Butler Yeats, and I'm not going to bore you with all of that again. Equally, Sloan's painting and his declamatory Irish tricolour, it looks more like the Italian flag, but actually it's supposed to be orange, not red, green, white and orange, hanging above the old man's head, leaves one in no doubt as to the Irish dimension. By contrast, what interests me today is when visual imagery includes an Irish presence which is substantially less declamatory and substantially less obvious. Such an Irish presence as exhibited, and I'm not going to go back over them because poor old Emily will be run mad. This is when I would have shown you everything in one great big slide. As exhibited in the Sloane or the Corbet or the Brown or the Mrs. Cameron or the Bingham or the Harn, all those images you've just been looking at, implies that there's more to the exploration of Irish representation than that produced in Ireland itself. And the same must apply to other cultures as well. Irish representation or any representation of art or art carrying a national prefix should not be limited by the birthplace of the artist, but should be permitted to include works that comment on an Irish issue, or a personage, or a phenomenon. All of the above images are owned by public museums. The Corbet is in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. The Brown is in the Manchester City Art Galleries. There are versions of the Mrs. Cameron photographs in the National Media Museum in Bradford, Yorkshire, which will soon move to the London V&A. While the Bingham is in St. Louis Art Museum, the Harness in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and the Sloane, which you're looking at, was formerly at the Corcoran, but it's now down the National Mall in the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Without exception, all of those institutions exhibit these works within the context of national schools, be they French, British, or American. Little is made in such displays beyond brief wall labels of the cultural mix that I've been describing. The story of migration needs to be shared with all museum visitors, regardless of their ethnic origins, and while thematic hangs do occur in a number of Western museums and galleries, the onus for more in-depth analysis rests with the discipline of art history and cognate research areas. The starting point for any analysis of an Irish diasporic art history is, of course, migration. As we know, at least 7 million people emigrated from Ireland to North America between the early 1700s and the 1920s. By 1870, three-quarters of those migrants lived in urban areas, urban sites. Historians have thus described the Irish diaspora as a predominantly urban group, with David Fitzpatrick in 1984 referring to Irish women migrants as a model industrial proletariat. Given that visual representation and our art tends to occur more within urban areas, it is worth examining some examples of urban art produced in Boston a few decades later at the beginning of the 20th century. I'd like to focus on two artists and a work by each. This one is by Edmund Tarbell and is called The Breakfast Room. And then the next one is by Joseph Rutherford de Camp, and I'm not, you know, if you've never heard of these people, don't worry about it. They're not necessarily household names. But both of whom, and this is called The Woman with the Blue Cup, both of whom are part of what's called the Boston School, as well as being members of what was called the 10 American Painters, which was founded in 1897. And both painted innumerable interiors, which include maidservants. And the maidservant here is this woman here. Okay, and here's Mr. and Mrs. whoever they are. Presumably the bosses of the servant. And both painted innumerable interiors, which include maidservants and are without their employers. In Tarbell's The Breakfast Room, which was painted about 1903, which is in the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, we see a couple at breakfast while a female servant stands in the background. In De Camp, next slide, in De Camp's The Blue Cup of 1909, so just a few years later, which is in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, a woman servant holds aloft a delicate cup and considers its translucence against the daylight. Given that the depiction of natural light dominates these two paintings and that they represent moments from modern life, both Tarbell and De Camp have been defined by the American curatorial world as representations of American Impressionism. As articulated in a 1994 exhibition, American Impressionism and Realism, The Painting of Modern Life, 1885 to 1915, organized by the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art, in terms of composition and tone, these works display an awareness of recent trends in European art, yet indulge in what the catalog calls a time for reflection. While no information is given in either of these paintings as to the national backgrounds of the domestic servants represented, historical facts are here worth considering. By 1900, 60.5% of Irish women in the United States were in domestic service, while in Boston, where these paintings were produced, 50% of the servants in Boston were Irish. Both Tarbell and De Camp participated in that statistic as they separately employed at least two Irish maidservants, yet that seems to have been the limit of their involvement with Ireland. And this is just going by their household kind of indexes. From at least the 1880s, the representation of Irish serving women in the United States had been seriously negative. One particular stereotype, the menacing simonized harridan, who it was suggested dominated the American kitchen, became commonplace with the Irish domestic scene as a threat to a nativist America. In this ostensibly humorous yet defiantly racist image dating from 1883, which if you looked closely yesterday at the exhibition, you would have, in the National Gallery, you would have seen it. One of the many images produced of these Irish domestic servants over a long period by Frederick Oper is this Irish woman as a fearsome bully and completely out of control. And then if you go back now, that's as much as you're going to get of Puck. If you go back to De Camp and our Tarbell. By contrast, in their highly polished images of women in interiors, Tarbell's and De Camp's canvases are a far cry from such stereotypes of Irish domestics. The Irish woman now features in a well-ordered world. I'm making a speculative comment that these are Irish women. I have no proof. I'm just going by what these guys had in the servants they had in their houses. And we know they use their servants as models. The Irish woman now features in a well-ordered world. Instead of an enormous redhead like the Puck woman a few minutes ago in a dress decorated with shamrocks, we get aproned, trim young women who do not raise their fists at their employers but attend to the chores or admire the material cultures. And I'm just showing you this one because I can't be bothered getting Emily to keep going back and forth. You know, you're going to have to keep that in your head, the other one as well. Okay, so they admire material indicators of a civilized lifestyle. Yet, as suggested by Elizabeth O'Leary, within these images, we should be aware of the historical context where acute tensions existed between Boston's upper classes and the ever-growing masses of immigrant workers. As O'Leary goes on to say in her book, At Beck and Call, The Representation of Domestic Servants in 19th Century America, which she published in 1996, These paintings do not, what she says, convey the heightened discord between families and their Irish maids. By contrast to the threatening air of the earlier imagery of the domestic servant, a seemingly placid air of harmony pervades the paintings by Tarbell and de Camp. But placidity can be illusory. In the de Camp, by looking at the blue cup, the servant woman is examining something that does not belong to her, and is thus, it can be argued, transgressing her role. In the Tarbell, can we find the Tarbell now? In the Tarbell, we observe the discrepancy between the middle upper class bohemia of the house owners in the foreground and the servant woman's uninvolvement in such a liberal lifestyle. With a maid, while the maid is suitably attired in her domestic uniform and is busy with her duties, the couple in the foreground do not converse, but are shown reading or considering their food. Such a casualness of behaviour is heightened by the woman's state of semi-undress, which is suitably echoed by the reclining nude in the Renaissance-like painting on the far wall. If these Boston paintings represent Irish domestic servants in the early 20th century United States, is it legitimate to discuss these works as being part of an Irish diasporic art history? It could be argued that by including a representations of Irish domestic servants in the United States, the Boston School is not illustrating either exilic or diasporic consciousness, because the works, now this is where I would have illustrated these words by Paul Gilroy, which are kind of quite complicated, but I haven't done it, so you have to listen carefully. So Paul Gilroy says in his definition of what a diasporic art or aesthetic could be, it could be claimed that these paintings do not exhibit, as Gilroy says, equalizing proto-democratic force of common territory, nor do they suggest an interest in the social dynamics of remembrance and commemoration, defined by a strong sense of the dangers involved in forgetting the location of origin and the process of dispersal. Instead, most of the art historical comment on these paintings by Tarbell and de Camp has not focused on their role as cutting-edge examples of a diasporic aesthetic. O'Leary, whose book I've referred to, one of the few academics to discuss these paintings in the context of Irish, and she really discusses them in the context of Irish domestics in the United States, rightly refers to Tarbell and de Camp as painting what she calls a conservative theme in a conservative style. In the wider literature, discussion has concentrated on their nostalgic, retrospective quality and their detachment from the hard facts of wage labour. Now, can you find Underwood and Underwood's stereographic photographs of... it's called How Biddy Served the Tomatoes, Undressed. Biddy Undressed, try that. Biddy Tomatoes, yeah. Come on there, that's great, wonderful. Okay. I love Google. While these images cannot be described as ever even remotely radical, the very presence of probable Irish domestic servants in these works make them part of an exilic art history. As such, by looking at Tarbell and de Camp in this way, we add an Irish dimension to American art history and an American dimension to Irish art history. Art history is important here. It's my discipline. As these works move beyond the visual stereotypes of the Irish emigrant, as it had developed in the 19th century and continued into the 20th century. 10 to 15 years after the image of Puck, of that wild harridan in the kitchen that I showed you, the New York company of... I'm sorry, this is rather high up. I hope you can see it. 10 or 15 years after the Puck, the New York company of Underwood and Underwood was producing humorous glass stereographs, you know, you see that you'd look two at the same time, they'd kind of merge and look three-dimensional, was producing humorous glass stereographs on the theme of Irish servants. The Underwood's hugely popular series focused on the dull-witted nature of the Irish servant. In one narrative card entitled, and this is it here, How Biddy Served the Tomatoes Undressed, dating from the 1890s, we see the Irish maidservant serving table in her nightdress due to our misunderstanding of the instructions, tomatoes undressed. By contrast, in the Tarbell and de Camp, if you can go back to those, one or two, either of those, by contrast, in these paintings, instead of condescension or risque imaginings, we get uncritical assimilation. O'Leary, as I've said before, for example, in her book Beck and Call, has suggested that the women in the de camp, if you can get the de camp, just seeing as we're talking about it, becomes an essay in the then recently fashionable cult of aestheticism. And that by admiring the delicate blue cup, the maid is indulging in the transforming power of culture. Equally, instead of debased national characteristics, we get his art historical quotations. Now, I'm going to have to depend on your visual memory here, because I can't bring myself to get Emily to run around looking up a whole bunch of things. Both Charbel and de Camp, along with many of their fellow Boston artists, if you go back to the Charbel, and others of the 10 group, that is Charbel, de Camp, and many others, I had trained in Europe, and thus not surprisingly, as was observed when first exhibited in 1904, this painting was first exhibited in 1904, the Charbel in its off-centered composition and cropped corners has affinities with the works of Edgar Degas. And I would have shown you Degas, but, you know, just bear with me, please. Indeed, I'm reminded of a comment by Robert Herbert, who wrote a great book on Impressionism in the 1980s, when he commented on Degas in his book that in a Glasgow painting called The Rehearsal, which shows a bunch of dancers, you kind of know the kind of thing, I hope, where there's a kind of a group of dancers on either side, the top left and the bottom right, and then there's a great gap in the middle, which I would have shown you. The figures are crowded, as Herbert says, into the upper left and lower right as active and passive figures separated by a clear zone. The Charbel has a similar structural dynamic, the maid being active in the top left here and the people in the foreground being passive. Can you show me the de Camp? In the de Camp, given the compositional dominance of the beam of daylight and the carefully articulate detail of the porcelain and china on the well-polished table, the blue cup attempts to approximate, and again I would have shown you a whole bunch of pictures, to approximate the luminosity of 17th century Dutch artist Johannes Vermeer. The attention to light may well remind us of Vermeer, but the painting's focus on a single woman worker has also reminded us of at least one other Dutch 17th century visual precedent, the artist Gerhard ter Borch, for example, who influenced the young Vermeer and who became famous for his everyday scenes involving women with a sexual subtext and a veiled innuendo. While it's not suggested here at all that such a theme is being perpetrated by de Camp, the artist did alter his image to allow the viewer to speculate as to her social status. To again quote O'Leary, who informs us that in his preliminary sketch for this painting, The Blue Cup, de Camp included the maid's dusty rag on a chair, bottom right-hand corner here, or maybe on the edge of the table, actually. He omitted the cloth in the final canvas and consequently eliminated the most obvious sign of domestic labour. In conjuring up these art historical memories, the representation of Irish domestic servants as included in these Boston school paintings of the early 20th century, there are no longer, I would argue, occasions for derogatory laughter, as they had been the case only so many decades before, very recently before, but now act as a means to display European high art ambitions, as in the quotations or references to Degas, Vermeer, ter Borch, whatever. Now, can you get me Brian Toll's Irish Memorial in New York, which you can be working on for the next sentence? In identifying a range of cross-cultural ingredients in the diasporic art history, one is helping to enlarge a national art history and not diluting it or lessening its potency. Any of those, that one there is fine. Just leave it at that. Contemporary art of our own day with an Irish orientation has not shied away from addressing the diaspora, be it on a small scale in a gallery occupying, as in this case, a whole block in Lower Manhattan. Brian Toll's Irish Hunger Memorial of 2002, which Emily here has written about very eloquently, occupies an elevated patch of earth a few stretches from ground zero. And while funded by the Battery Park City Authority, the visualization was inspired by the West Mayo landscape. Toll's creation asks us to reflect on migration through our own physical immersion in Irish landscape. Other disciplines within the cultural wing of Irish studies have been discussing such cross-cultural connections for years. Recent academic work by Diane Negre and Sinead Moynihan has focused on Irishness in the US with regards to popular culture with explorations in recent films, TV programs, fiction and performances such as Riverdance. Classic Irish-American 20th century drama is also rich in diasporic references. In Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey and Tonight, written in 1941-2 and published and first performed in 1956, the father of the family, as you might remember, James Tyrone, is endlessly being criticized for his poverty-stricken Irish peasant origins and his concerns about overspending, the need for owning property, and the fear, as his wife puts it, of ending his days in poverty. These accusations form part of a conversation between Mary Tyrone and her servant Kathleen, the second girl, our under-housemaid, as she's described by O'Neill, as a buxom Irish peasant in her early 20s with a red-cheeked, comely face and black hair and blue eyes. And here I would have shown you a still from a production, but it takes half an hour to find it, so just bear with me. Although written long after the creation of the paintings by Tarbell and de Camp, in his play O'Neill, which is set in 1912 and in New England, where the Boston pictures were produced, maintains the historical fact of a New England homes employing Irish domestic servants. Bridget is the name of the other housemaid, although she never appears in the play. As described by O'Neill, Kathleen is amiable, ignorant, clumsy, possessed by a dense, well-meaning stupidity. Indeed, in her interactions with the Tyrone family, we see her as uncouth, offhand, and decidedly dim. Unlike the equally Irish-born James Tyrone, a now renowned actor, with a voice that is remarkably fine and resonant and flexible, Kathleen has failed to defeat the brogue and speaks in a thick Irish accent. In one case, she talks about the impotence of him in Act Three of A Man in the Drugstore. As such, O'Neill's Kathleen maintains many of the stock stereotypes of the Irish domestic as had been visualized in Oprah's cartoon of 1883. Can you go back to one or other of the Tarbell? Yeah, excuse me, I blow my nose. Despite all these examples of cultural interconnections, the focus of this talk is on paintings, and in particular art that is accessible in public museums, such as those images reproduced here from collections in Boston, as in the other picture, and this one in Philadelphia. In the discipline of art history, we need to be more inclusive in defining a diasporic art history and acknowledge the important role of migration and its relationship with art production. Although it has been a slow process, others are saying this too. For example, the Los Angeles-based art historian Saloni Matur has suggested that human mobility in the world is an issue that art history has largely ignored, and that there is a necessity, she says, of integrating the themes of migration into the critical practices of art historical research. To Matur, the gains of such an integration are that they will allow for the exploration of the relationship of the visual arts to the forms of subjectivity produced by migration and displacement. The study of art needs to be involved in what she calls challenging or consolidating the conditions of globalization and its histories, and the implications of a world that is understood as both inextricably interconnected and mercilessly blocked by the politics of barriers and boundaries for historiography, writing, and the narratives of art history. In his 1990 essay, Cultural Identity and Diaspora, Stuart Hall talked of the notion of imaginary reunification and the creation of a photographic account of the peoples of the Black Triangle, that is Africa, Caribbean, the USA and the UK. The art history that I'm advocating needs to construct in visual terms a comparable Irish diasporic archive. For some years, archives of Irish visual material have existed in educational institutions in Dublin, but the focus has been on collecting data on Irish artists or artists who worked in Ireland. More needs to be done to collect data relating to the Irish diaspora. Transatlantic Irish history is becoming a sophisticated area of research, but following Hall's suggestion, it, like Black history, needs to acknowledge the visual more than just an area useful to illustrate an established narrative. Instead, it needs to be acknowledged that the visual has a history of its own. Why do we need such a diasporic art history for things Irish or any other cultural group? Well, I think we need it because it announces the maturity of a national art history. Irish art history is thus broadened, as is American, in the case of America, obviously, The latter is now a well-established area of research, while Irish art history needs to move beyond a biographical preoccupation. To again quote from Stuart Hall, the diasporic in art is not defined by essence or purity, but is about identifying things within a mixed society. The women in these paintings by Tarbell or de Camp, be they mistresses or maid, are not involved in what O'Leary has referred to as the bothersome idiosyncrasies widely attributed to their ethnic group or class. These are paintings of things hoped for that offer a comforting antidote to the challenging conditions beyond the private mahogany parlour doors of the Black Bay district of Boston. The visual imagery of Irish women in late 19th or early 20th century United States is a yet to be fully explored sight. The Irish servant women in these paintings of the first decade of the 20th century, who appear in these Boston paintings, are part of Irish visual history and need to be incorporated into the national story. A comparative method is one way to examine the diasporic in art. So we could, as I have done in the past, discuss that painting by Ford Madox Brown's work, Are the Corbeys' giant canvas the studio of the artist, which he referred to as representing society at its best, at its worst, and its average, and analyse the depiction of both the Irish peasant in those pictures. In English and French paintings, the focus is on emigration and poverty, and by offering a lengthy discussion of the combined British and French context, a more international perspective is permitted. By extension, the examination of Irish-related visual imagery in the United States in the late 19th century and early 20th century allows us to identify a discernible Irish dimension to an otherwise American art history. When we look at a celebrated American 20th century, early 20th century American image, such as this one here by George Bellows of Paddy Flanagan, 1908, we need to analyse such a work so as to articulate an interest in an Irish diasporic presence. While the academics Robert Schneider and Rebecca Zurier have written about this New York painting of a teenage boy with a distinctly Irish name and how it shares what they call the characteristics of scrappiness that was assigned to all young Irishmen in the conventions of the time, they say that offers a fairly positive, and I'm quoting them, representation. Paddy Flanagan, they suggest, he may be thin, but there is nothing cruel about him. Other art historical discussions of Bellows' painting of Paddy Flanagan completely ignore the boy's ethnic origins. And I'm not going to ask you, Emily, to do this, because again, it's a bit of a troll. While other more catalogue entries compare this painting with artists such as Caravaggio, or Franz Hals, 17th century Italian, or Netherlandish artists, while the catalogue that accompanied the most recent big Bellows exhibition at the Met in New York limits its comments to the painting on the painting to quoting a 1908 review which refers to the painting as a pearl of the gutter. Also, what we must avoid is the sentimental popularism of the sort that followed the display of this painting at the Met in 2013, that Paddy, in a blog, had finally made it to the Met. One blog posted on an Irish-American website commented on how, and I quote, this painting of this poor boy that must have suffered so much from poverty and neglect breaks my heart. But it brings home what many Paddies suffered in the early days in New York. Instead, in articulating an Irish diasporic art history, we need to seriously analyse these representations in terms of the history of migration and the visual awareness of an Irish diaspora in urban America. In doing this, we can go beyond the usual suspects, be they Bellows or Sloane, whom I showed you earlier, or the gritty realism of Sloane's school, the Ashcan Group, which has a whole list of Irish references. We need to tease out Irish diasporic representation by analysing a wide range of visual material, which includes the not so obvious, as in the works as the Tarbell and the de Camp, where I'm suggesting they have an Irish dimension. Clearly, the visual history of exile as it concerns Ireland is not confined to a study of the Irish in the United States, or as Kevin Kenny and other historians have argued, includes Irish settlements in Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, or wherever. Back in 1997, the introduction to my first book, Visual Politics, The Representation of Ireland, 1750 to 1930, I argued that an examination of how Ireland was represented should not just be about Irish art. That is, and I'm quoting myself, an exclusory preoccupation with defining a particular school. Rather, it's about the representation between Ireland and the visual. That term, the visual, is not limited by national borders or national schools of art history, and thus can include a range of images produced by non-Irish artists throughout the world. As has been explored in this talk, by analysing a couple of Boston school artists, a group firmly established, or enshrined rather, within the American school, in terms of how a diasporic consciousness can manifest itself, we liberate an otherwise restrictive national label and offer it a range of interpretations. In an attempt to achieve the visual history of the Irish diaspora, the ESB Centre for the Study of Irish Arts, based in the National Gallery of Ireland, is planning to set up what we might call a database of relevant images. The first part of this project is what you saw yesterday, the Pathos of Distance exhibition. This collaboration between an artist, Sarah Pierce, and the gallery uses a selection of Irish migrant images so as to allow us, the audience, that is, to visually explore the concept of diaspora. In time, it's hoped that an expanded database will reveal the range of diasporic images in a multitude of media. Meanwhile, as I said earlier, I'm in the process of researching a book on the theme of art and exile relating to Ireland in the long 19th century, where some of the ideas that I've been sharing with you today will be elaborated upon and will hopefully prove interesting. The creation of an Irish diasporic art history archive will go some way towards informing us on what material there is. By collecting data and imagery on human mobility, to again use Saloni Mathur's phrase, as it represents the Irish people over the past centuries, will force students and academics, as well as institutional curators, to pay close attention to a heretofore underplayed aspect of national art history. A diasporic art history is often hidden and needs time-consuming investigation. But in the end, its exploration will make the discipline far more interesting and culturally enriching. Thank you.
Thanks, Fintan. That was fantastic. My name is Donal Maguire from the National Gallery of Ireland. This idea of rethinking the models or the structures in which we talk about art history, and particularly schools of art history. And we can't, I suppose, one of the dominant forces in defining that has defined what Irish, the school of Irish art over the past century is, or post-colonial history, and or perhaps our search or want to define a national school of painting that reflects our Irish national identity. And we can talk about that in the context of what Ireland is and the board, our borders and our, I suppose, national cultural identity links to the idea of a nation state. And we found when we were working on the project that diaspora provides a much greater challenge in that sense, that we can talk about the Irish-American experience or the Australian-Irish experience or the Canadian-Irish experience, but diaspora is something different again, and it crosses. We use it quite liberally sometimes to talk about a massive population spanning hundreds of years that covers, encompasses many different locations. And we don't have the same standards or the same models to rely on in terms of how it's defined that we do when we talk about states and nations and countries and things like that. And I think the current discourse doesn't provide us with, or isn't useful enough in talk in terms of defining what Irish diaspora is. So we have government policy talking about throwing out the same kind of information about this population of 70 million without really talking about who that is and who these people are, and defining what it is. And I'm just wondering, is this something that you've thought about, or perhaps how we might look to define, if we're going to talk about, you use the term Irish diasporic art history, talk about what are the definitions or the standards by which we define Irish diaspora. Sorry to put you on the spot.
I've just tried to do that in the last 50 minutes. Well, I think there are kind of two, because we're short of time and it's another question, I'm going to be brief. There are two things. One is nation states vis-a-vis Ireland don't come into course until the 1920s. And diaspora went on a long time before that and continued for the last 100 years. So you've got to kind of deal with that nation state question. I mean, a lot of the people who went in pre-1920 were not necessarily, they might have been leaving Ireland, but they weren't leaving a nation as defined by the international bodies. Also, I'm very concerned, and this study that I hopefully will write, I'm not concerned just with one type of, as I said at the beginning, a huddled mass or a kind of poor, dislodged, indigent person. I'm interested in the whole range of different types. And in art and visual representation, because I'm an art historian, I've got to go with art. I've got to go with visual stuff. I'm not a historian of migration in terms of pure facts, of written texts. So I want to look at a range of different types. And people go away, and people migrate, and people go into exile. I'm an exile, and I'm, you know, not exactly an indigent. And that's got to be taken into account. So people join the army, people go into a whole range of consular affairs in the 19th century, and they are exiles. And we find them in India, we find them in China and Australia. And that's a diaspora as much as the poor person who goes to Ellis Island. So it has to be broad, and I hope that my contribution, as vain as I might sound to be saying this, will help us. And you and I and others setting up these databases will hopefully define things, but it's an early stage yet. Other cultures, the Americans, the Italians, the Russians, are doing some of this as well. So I think we need to learn from each other.
Yes. A bit running short on time, so I'll give the last question to Niamh.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Mine is a slightly more methodological question, if I may. How do you think you will cope with the differences between representations by Irish artists, of Irish subjects, and even just looking at your Boston paintings, they're imaginary subjects. You know, if you're not sure that they are Irish, but they may be. So
yeah, but I don't think it's, well, good question. And I'm not necessarily concerned about that, because to me, representation is, I'm trying to go beyond borders. I'm not interested just in Irish art. I'm interested in Irish representation, which could be by the Harnett and others are very decidedly Irish. Art history or any form of intellectual discipline would be the worst if we did not occasionally speculate. So I've got to, you know, the facts tell me of the huge percentage of Irish domestic service in Boston at a particular time. Can we see these pictures? I wandered around the Met or Boston or wherever, Philadelphia, and saw these pictures and thought, oh, domestic servants, and I checked my stats, and that's what led me to do this. The same with, you know, Musée d'Orsay or any other paint gallery I wandered around. Oh, there's an Irish woman. What am I supposed to forget about that? Because that's what interests me, is when I see, or that, you know, the Harnett picture. I knew nothing about Harnett, but I was wandering around the Met one day and saw Tom Moore's Lake of Killarney. There must be something Irish about this. So that. I'm trying to suggest to people that you can go beyond, you know, if it's in the RIA five books of Irish art and architecture, there must be more to Irish art than that, or Irish representation. And I'm trying to, I mean, I don't want to sound like a John the Baptist in the wilderness, but I'm trying to liberate ourselves. Does that sound a bit pompous?
just to conclude, one of the things I think that Donal's pointing to as well, and I think all of us are conscious, many folks in this room who've worked on the famine for some time and who've been interested as well in the revival of famine memory in the 1990s and the continued presence of it within public culture, something that this conference is part of as well. I think we've also seen to a certain extent the ossification of certain forms of representation, be it visual, be it the way that we see the Irish famine represented when you type in famine on Google, just as I was doing. What are the types of images that appear to us? How has that sort of system of representation, even in the last 20 years, become, I think, in some ways quite stale and sometimes perhaps impervious to new forms of rethinking about this subject. So I think in many ways what Fintan is talking about here, and is a very, you know, quite a bold stance to take on widening this conception of diaspora, something that in many cases I think is at odds of, in terms of what's happening nationally. We have the new migration center that's opening in CHQ next month that's going to be presenting a whole visual and sensorial experience of migration. And I think in many ways it will actually probably wind up being something, because I've seen the interpretative plans, something quite antagonistic to exactly what Fintan is describing. So I think in many cases what you're saying here will be a very welcome, I think, intervention and counterbalancing to some of the dominant narratives within Irish art. I won't eat into your lunch at any more length. Fintan will be upstairs, and of course we can continue this discussion and conversation for the rest of today and into tomorrow. But just join me in thanking Fintan in the spite of technological troubles.